New Southerners, Part 9 of a series highlighting contemporary Southern fiction, next on Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Novelist Tina McElroy Anza is here with readings and conversation about her latest book, Ugly Ways, the story of a mother and her three daughters in the modern South.
Knowing Annie Ruth, she's going to go through my bed jackets and personal things before the funeral to see what she can take back to that Los Angeles. Maybe my pink satin quilted bed jacket to wear with some tight jeans or expensive evening dress. I can hear her now. Oh, yes, this was my Madea's. I just had to have something of hers. Little witch. God, them girls got ugly ways about them sometimes. They must get them from their father's people.
Writer Tina McElroy Anza. She'll be back in just a moment with readings and conversation about her latest book, Ugly Ways. Major funding for this program comes from the Lila Wallace Reader's Digest Fund. Soundings is a cultural affairs service of the National Humanities Center. The image of black women in Southern fiction had its beginnings in slave narratives. Those were pictures, however, frequently lacking in human complexity. By contrast, writers like Zora Neale Hurston and William Faulkner offered us portraits of strong and spirited women with lasting attachments to family and the Southern landscape. More recently, the fictional image of black women in the South has taken an unusual turn in the work of Tina McElroy Anza, who deliberately departs from conventional notions of the self-sacrificing matriarch. Tina McElroy Anza's latest book is a novel entitled Ugly Ways. Set in the imaginary town of Mulberry, Georgia, Ugly Ways revolves around a family reunion. With their father, the Lovejoy sisters, Betty, Emily, and Annie Ruth, each in her own way sexy and successful, have come together for their mother's funeral. The mother's name is Esther, but throughout the book she's Mudir, a combination of monster and goddess, tyrant and teacher. Moving between the present moment and recollections of its mutual past, and speaking to us in alternating voices, the family prepares for Mudir's memorial. In doing so, the Lovejoy women and their father find themselves coming to terms with a woman whose power over her family continues even after her death. Ugly Ways is a blend of authentic speech, African-American humor, Southern folklore, and social commentary. With the first two of several excerpts she'll read from Ugly Ways, here's Tina McElroy Anza.
She knew better than to press Madea for a response to the photographs and the accomplishments they chronicled. Her response was always so demoralizing. No matter what the pictures showed, Betty in her high school cap and gown, Betty at graduation from cosmetology school, Betty in front of her first beauty shop, Lovejoy's, at its grand opening, Madea always managed to say just about the same thing. God, daughter, your butt sure look big in these pictures. Even when Essence magazine did a short profile of her after she opened her second beauty shop, and when Ebony made note of the annual hair and beauty show she put on, Betty just left the magazines by Madea's bed, turned to the page with her picture circled. Madea never did say she read the articles, but she did tell Betty later that she had enjoyed the short story in the issue of Essence. Still, Betty couldn't stop herself from bringing the pictures to Madea and laying them before her like a burnt offering to Yemaya, the Yoruba goddess of the womb. She told herself that was the least she owed her own mother, even if her own mother reminded her of Madea. It's like as long as we all keep talking and thinking like every black mother in the world is this great, wonderful, self-sacrificing matriarch. Right, not counting the women who have children on welfare, or who are drug addicts, or who are children still themselves, Betty said. You know as well as I do that those women aren't considered real black mothers. They just lazy black hoes, Annie Ruth said. That is, till they are of a certain age and become grandmothers themselves, taking in their babies' babies. Yeah, then they real mothers, Betty offered. Well, Emily said, continuing her thought, it's like as long as we don't think about our mothers as anything but these huge black breasts oozing chocolate milk on demand, we keep all our demons in check. But now you know, Muddy always bragged on the fact that she breastfed all her children, Betty said with a sly smile. It was a fact that Muddy had tossed at them when she sensed any inchoate rebellion growing among her ranks. Yeah, she breastfed us all right, but she didn't never give us no tit, Annie Ruth said. Madea is the creation, I guess, from my mind, but also from mothers that I have heard about and seen. I'm not in a room more than a couple of hours with a woman before I know something about her mother. We women talk about our mothers all the time. I know what my friend's mother's favorite phrase is, or her favorite color, or what she would tell her when she was growing up. There's something about motherhood. You
know. Is this your mom? Let's cut to the autobiography early on here.
Out of the way, okay?
Yeah, you bet.
No, indeed it's not. I don't think I would be sitting here if that were indeed my mother. I don't know if I could survive this woman. She definitely is not my mother, but there are certain elements of my mother there, I think, the kinds of things that my mother wanted for me. This Madea, as you called her, a monster early, and I don't know whether she's really a monster so much as she is seen that way, or she became a monster over the years just because she became so self-focused. Madea is the most self-focused, selfish person I think I have ever encountered. But there's certainly elements of her. My mother, especially Black mothers, I think, African-American mothers, have a way of putting an idea into a very short, pithy sort of phrase, and my mother does that too.
Well, one of the tricks that you pull off in this book, Tina, is you present her as both a maternal, a Black matriarch, mm-hmm. with all of the virtues that one would associate with that, mm-hmm. and yet she has her demons, and she imposes those demons on these three little girls.
Well, you know, I think so often we see our mothers, not just African American mothers, but mothers, period, is not human, is not having gone through puberty, is mm-hmm. not having mothers of their own, is not having all their own baggage and garbage that they're dealing with.
Right.
You know, we think that they appear full-blown when we come out of their womb. And I think that that's so unfair. It keeps us from knowing our mothers, from knowing ourselves, from being gentle with each other, from being forgiving, from being honest with each other. And I think that Madea is an example of about as honest as you can get. You know, that's one of her flaws and certainly one of her wonderful traits. I think Madea is a victim and a victimizer. I think Madea is a good mother in the sense that there were things that she wants for her girls. She sees herself as a good mother. She sees herself as being proud of her girls. But uh-huh. the girls never knew this. The girls have no sense that she even knows what's going on with them, let alone that she's a good mother, that she cares about what they're doing and they're proud of.
Is she a model for Black feminism?
Oh,
can
my
we,
God.
Can
I
we
hope,
be that?
Oh, I hope Madea isn't a model for anybody other than the fact of how not to do many things. But I think my novel is about freedom, Wayne. It uh-huh. really is. It's about what happens when a Black woman, a Black mother in our society decides she's going to be free and how that impacts on people. And I think feminism is indeed about freedom, as any human movement is about freedom.
It's also about responsibility. And
well,
here's one of the levels where this character just in many ways falls down,
yeah.
and is not certainly a model for Black motherhood.
Oh, well, I don't think she's a model for any, you know, any motherhood in the sense of responsibility. But I think that she does have something to offer when she talks about taking responsibility for yourself. Well, now, I mean, when you think about it, she really does take responsibility for herself. She just doesn't take responsibility for anybody else.
It's a kind of an indirected yeah. way that she teaches this lesson uh-huh. to her mm-hmm. three girls.
Well, I mean, look at the girls. I mean, they're overachievers. I mean, they have achieved more than anybody can expect of them. And I think that that's quite true for Black women in this country. I mean, I see them all the time. It's gotten to the point now that Black women don't even get good strokes for all the things that they do because you're expected to be a superwoman.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's true. We have learned, as feminists, we've learned that that's true of all women. You know, we're expected to be breadwinners and to be there for children and to be sensitive when we're supposed to be sensitive, be strong when we're supposed to be strong. And I've heard that same, as a matter of fact, I've heard that same complaint from men. You know, what do women want from us? Do they want us to be sensitive? Or do they want us to be strong and in charge? You know, I think that these are questions for the 21st century. And I think that they are part of the modern South because I don't think that they could have existed any other time.
One of the things that struck me about this this wonderful novel that you've written is that race is a factor in this book, but it is not Blacks against whites. It is not some sort of defining mm-hmm. oneself against mm-hmm. the larger world.
Mm-hmm.
It is an internal kind of phenomenon mm-hmm. that you have working mm-hmm. in your book. Am I right about this?
I think so. Certainly race is a defining issue for all of us. But I think the way that traditionally we have seen race is in terms of people of color being the other outside the mainstream, seeing ourselves in that context. And certainly what I am trying to do in my fiction, and especially in Ugly Ways, is to see each of us is human beings with our own cultural and racial backgrounds, and that certainly shapes us, but not in connection with other people, but with ourselves, with our own inner demons, with our own sense of identity, where we fit in, that kind of thing, where we fit into the family as well as where do we fit into the larger culture.
Tina, tell me about your experience as an observer of the South. How much has the South changed? How far have we come, so to speak?
Oh, so difficult for me to ask because I am such a child of the South. I really love the South. I lived for a while in Maryland, which I call the North. People laugh at me when I say that.
It's a border state.
But as I say, you know, that's far enough North for me. Thank you very much. I miss grits. I missed driving along a country road and seeing a farmer off in the field, you know, and I'd honk my horn and he'd raise his hand and in anonymous greeting, you know, didn't know me from Adam, wouldn't even know whether I was a man or a woman in the car. I missed the Georgia tomato. I missed everything that I considered about the South. I missed the idea of family and a garden in the yard, or going next door and asking somebody, can I have some of your bunch of your greens, because your greens look better than my greens.
Well, you sure make this garden in ugly ways sound good.
Isn't it a wonderful garden?
You bet it is.
It's a wonderful. Muddy is truly, the only thing Muddy truly loves, I guess, in life, if she were honest with herself, is her garden, because she created it. Uh-huh. She created it.
Are you having some fun with us here, Tina? I mean, have you created, as you said, a Yoruba goddess, a kind of vegetable queen who is both a black matriarch and a kind of a literary archetype at the same time?
Well, I hope so. As we said last night, you know, I am trying to write literature here. not necessarily with a capital L, but certainly with a, with an L. I certainly am trying to say something other than the story. I see my work, hopefully, as literature I see it as like a tort, you know, with lots of levels. And indeed, if you just want to take that top level and eat the icing about three girls who come home to bury their mother in this small fictional town of Mulberry, and, you know, you laugh at certain parts and cry at certain parts, well, that's fine. If that's what you want, that's fine. But if you bite into it and get into all the layers and the richness of life, of family life, of human life, of how we hurt each other without meaning to, and how we help each other and love each other and are generous and are selfish, I mean, if you bite into that, I think you come away with a lot more. So that's truly what I am trying to do.
Now, you say that you're writing literature with a big or a little L. How much of a sense do you have, Tina, of your connection to what we might call the tradition of Southern writing? Do you have heroes and heroines that consciously or otherwise you find yourself imitating or being accused of imitating?
Well, I don't think accused is the word. I mean, I've been honored to be compared, my writing sometime, to Zora Neale Hurston, who I think is truly very much a Southern-focused writer and not so much an Afrocentric writer as a black folk-centric writer, real sense of what black people were and their inner life and their feelings and their journeys in this life. And I certainly see her as a hero, a shiro, someone that I admire, but I want to write like Tina McElroy on, so I want to be an original, and I think that we all, you know, indeed want that. So even though I certainly hold her up in her sense of herself and her identity as a black person and a person from the South, and I hope that I do that, I hope that I'm writing something new here and something original, and I'm capturing something that we see around us all the time but very seldom see on the pages of literature.
You're listening to Soundings, a magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Novelist Tina McElroy Anza is here with Part 9 of New Southerners, a continuing series highlighting the work of contemporary Southern writers. Her most recent book is Ugly Ways, a story of a mother and her three daughters in the modern South. With two more excerpts from Ugly Ways, here again is Tina McElroy Anza.
With all their work and Mudia's hair done, they had spent the late Saturday afternoon just roaming around their own backyard, being careful to avoid stepping on Mudia's plants. In their boredom and anger, their talking about Mudia seemed as natural as listlessly drawing circles in the dirt with a stick. "She's so mean and low down," Emily said first. "Yeah," Betty agreed. "She don't care nothing about nothing but her own self. Now she upstairs in that house just looking at herself in the mirror with nice, clean hair. She thinks she's so cute," Annie Ruth offered, and was gratified that her little input was greeted with amens from her older sisters. It emboldened her. "Wearing those old funny-looking flowered pastel robes all the time," she added. Yeah, like she's sick all the time, Emily said. She make me sick. And they all giggled at Emily's little joke. They were just getting revved up. There in Muddy's garden next to the marigolds and tomato plants, they talked about her lovelessness, her heartlessness, her lack of motherliness. Yeah, Emily said, she's the reason we don't get invited anywhere hardly as it is. They think we as funny acting as she is, and nobody want to come visit if they can't even go to the bathroom. All of a sudden, they knew something was amiss. It seemed that the very breeze had suddenly stopped blowing in the yard. They all looked up to the house's back porch at the same instant and saw her standing at the screen door dressed in a fresh flowered pastel house coat, listening. They nearly fell to their knees right on the spot, waiting for the bolt of lightning called up by their mother to strike them all dead. Emily even brought her hands together in a plaintive gesture of supplication, and Annie Ruth started whimpering in fear. When she heard her father's sharp voice in her parents' bedroom next door, she sat straight up in bed. "You been laying around in bed all day?" Her father's voice, even through the bedroom wall, was strong, unbelieving, and angry. "Did you get up at all today?" All she could hear of her mother's voice was a sleepy, muffled sound. "What about the girls?" He was almost sputtering with rage. "You been looking after them? Good God, the baby just got over being sick. Did you even fix them something to eat?" Another muffled sound and a long stretch, "My dear," in reply. "Woman, don't you hear me talking to you? Your family's hungry," Papa shouted. There was a slight pause, and then My dear said, "I done it, and when I done it, my whole family done it." Papa seemed as stunned by the statement as Betty was. The little girl could hear her father take two steps toward the bed in his heavy, chalk-covered work boots, but My dear's voice stopped the advance. "And cut up that heat on your way out," she said. Then Betty heard the rustle of sheets and quilts as Muddy settled back to sleep.
Tina, what goes on in your book between the men and the women? You have a father figure. I described him to you as a kind of a ghost on these pages. You also have references to the way black men and black women meet and counter one another. You use really a kind of a harsh phrase in the third place, the blood the internecine blood letting that happens among and between black people. It's pretty grim stuff.
Well, I think all you have to do is look around you and cut on the TV to see the grim stuff that's going on in life. I mean, all we have to do is look at some rap lyrics to see how, in particular, black men are viewing black women now and how black women view black men.
Now, is this a particularly Southern kind of thing that's going on here?
I don't think so. I think it's a national problem. It's a national concern. We see it in the halls of high schools. I have heard young people tell me, young women tell me that young boys, you know, will call them a bitch or call them a hoe. I mean, and this is acceptable. You see it acceptable in our language sometimes, in music.
Well, are you talking to us at a fictional level, Tina, about how to solve or address this problem in our society, whether it's the South or the whole country that we're talking about, by way of the way these three girls in your book have been raised?
No, I think I'm trying to address it by bringing it up so there can be some discussion about it. So often I think we sit around on our kitchen tables or over the phone or, you know, over a drink, and we talk about things that really, really matter to us, how we're treated by men, when I'm thinking of women now, how we view men. But so seldom do we see it on the pages of books, the things that really shape us. I think that's why I'm trying to write literature. Literature really is a reflection of our lives, of a people's heart, of a people's spirit. And I think that one of the things that we have to do, I certainly don't think these girls handle it very well. They don't know anything about loving men. They've never been taught how to love a man. You know, so that's why they're screwing this, Muddy'll say, everything in shoe leather. But they don't know anything about true love. So certainly the girls don't have any answers, but I think they want answers. They want to talk about it. They want to say, how did we get to this point that a black man and a black woman can't even say hello to each other on the street anymore? They've had such a hard time, but they really want to. As the novel opens, they've come home to bury Muddy'll, and they really want to bury a lot of other things. They want to bury all these demons. They know that they're crazy, you know, and they've had it up to here. with Madhya. They've had it up to here with being crazy. They have achieved things. They have money. They have wonderful jobs. They love clothes. They're beautiful women. They have relationships that are, you know, sometimes good and sometimes bad. And they know they should be happy. They should have some more joy, some more love in their lives. And they don't. And what they want to do is they want to bury Madhya, bury some of the demons, forgive, heal, and get on. So I feel hopeful for the girls simply because I think that they know how crazy they are. You know, you have to realize that you're really crazy before you can take some steps with it. But they know how unhappy and crazy they are, and they want to do something about it. I think the fact that that Annie Ruth, the baby, wants to have a baby, wants to have a child, wants to be a mother.
That's a bright sign at the end of the book.
Yeah, even though they have vowed as girls when they became teenagers. Not to ever have children because they were afraid they were going to be like Madhya. I think that's one of the fears that all women have, and one of the fears and one of the hopes that we have in some ways that we will be like our mothers, in some ways that we won't be like our mothers.
Tina, you had great fun with us in this book. A lot of great comic scenes in addition to the very serious dimensions in Ugly Ways. One of the great comic scenes is in the funeral parlor. Tell me what happens between Annie Ruth and her mom.
Well, you know, I have noticed the older I get people in my family die, that in a funeral, when someone in the family dies, when mortality is right in your face, emotions are right under the surface, and things happen that you would never think would happen in a million years. People say things that they would never say. People tell you that they love you because they realize they don't have forever. But just as often, people start fights and get angry and, you know, want to get things out in the open that you would think this is not the time to do that.
And that's what happens with Annie Ruth.
That's exactly what happens. They go down. Annie Ruth decides that she has had it up to here, as I said, with Madhya. And the girls have never felt comfortable talking with their mother, not honestly. They've never told them how much pain she's dumped on them, how angry they've been at them, how angry they have been for her pushing them out into the world and making them handle things while she stayed at home and looked at television and garden, made them go out into the world and be the crazy woman's children in Mulberry. And Annie Ruth says she's had it. She's going to have this baby. Before she has this baby, she's going to go down to Parkinson Funeral Home and get in Madhya's face and tell her just what she thinks about her. And the other sisters are shocked. They go, "Oh, Annie Ruth, don't you dare go out of this house shaming us in the street." And Annie Ruth says, "Don't y'all get it?" She says, "We didn't ever do anything to shame us in this town. It's Madhya who shamed us." And she says, "I'm going to tell her." She jumps in the car. She runs down to drives down to the funeral home and storms into the funeral home looking for Madhya. "Where's my Madhya? I want to find her." And she finds her lying in the coffin. And she starts yelling at her. The girls come in and find her. They go, "Stop this. I'm not going to let you do this." They start tugging on each other, trying to pull one away from the coffin. And, of course, what happens is the coffin gets knocked over. Madhya comes sliding out of the coffin. The girls fall on the floor, you know, in a tangle of expensive jewelry and designer perfume and silk dresses and high heel boots, and they get all tangled together and they fall on the floor, and Madhya comes sliding out of the casket.
But they also start to come to terms with one another.
Hey, when your mother's corpse is lying in your lap and on the floor of Parkinson Funeral Home, I got the most wonderful note from a friend of mine saying, "What a riot. Annie Ruth, Betty, and Emily, cozy with Esther on the floor of Parkinson's funeral home." Cozy. Isn't that a wonderful word? That's exactly what they are. They're cozy with her for the first time. And they look in her face, and they speak from their hearts, and they speak of the hurt she's dumped on them. And they tell them, "You know, you didn't have to do that, Madhya. You didn't have to turn on us just because your life was hard. You didn't have to do that." And they tell them, "I'm sorry that this is the way things have gone. I'm sorry you've died before we got the chance to tell you this, but we're going to put you in the ground, and we're going to bury a lot of the pain and the anger with you, and we're going to try to go on with life."
Tina, let's move toward a conclusion of our conversation. What are you working on right now? Can you tell us, give us a quick preview here?
Sure, I'm working on two things. I'm working on my third novel, which for people who enjoyed Baby the Family, I hope will be a gift. It is a sequel of sort. It takes some of the characters from Baby the Family, especially the main character, Lena, who is the child born with a caul or veil over her face, who sees ghosts, and takes her into adulthood. And it's going to be a love story with Lena and the story of her falling in love.
All right, now that's one project. What was the other one?
The other is a project I'm very excited about. It's called The Mulberry Tales. It's a book of short stories, simply because this fictional town of Mulberry, I just find infinitely interesting.
This is your Yaknapatawpha.
This is absolutely my Yaknapatawpha, and it's a wonderful, wonderful creation as far as I'm concerned. Small towns are so interesting to me because they're very much like families. You know, there's the intimacy of knowing everything, but then there's also all these secrets that people don't know about. Truly, all these secrets, the things that you don't know, and how the relationships work, the dynamics of families. You know, how the oldest is always a certain way, and the baby is always a certain way. Well, a town is the same way. You know, the person who runs the newspaper is a certain kind of person. The person who runs the funeral home, you know, the person who's a homeless person. They all have their place in the town. So this little town of Mulberry, which is in Middle Georgia,
that's on
fictional
your mind.
Town, indeed, and is peopled by all these wonderful, wonderful characters who don't necessarily fit into a novel, a larger work, but who have stories of their own to tell. And so I'm going to write this, publish this book with Harcourt Brace as well as the third novel, and my husband, who is a filmmaker, and I plan to produce these short stories as short films for cable.
Oh, that's great. Mm-hmm.
To reach all those people who don't read, and hopefully to bring, you know, these TV babies back to, and cable babies back to reading, you know, back to the word, which I think is so important, which I think is so Southern, the idea of storytelling, of the oral, you know, the word spoken as well as the word written.
Tina McElroy Anze is the author of two novels. Her first book, Baby of the Family, was published in 1989. Her second book, Ugly Ways, was published in 1993. Both Baby of the Family and Ugly Ways are available from Harcourt Brace. Stay tuned for information about writing for an audio cassette of this program. The program is Soundings, a magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. You've been listening to Part 9 of New Southerners, a continuing series highlighting the work of contemporary Southern writers. My guest was novelist Tina McElroy Anze. Upcoming segments on New Southerners will feature readings and conversation with four more writers, Brent Wade, Randall Keenan, Josephine Humphreys, and Robert Olin Butler. For an audio cassette of this program, send $10 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. Please ask for program number 721. That's number 721, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. The music you heard on this show is from an album entitled The Devil's Dream and featured the Tarwater Band. Thanks for listening to Soundings. Major funding for New Southerners comes from the Lila Wallace Reader's Digest Fund. Soundings is a cultural affairs service of the National Humanities Center.